So we're going to get started with the workshop on state repression and with our speakers here, Subhash, Aziz, and Nandita. We're just to remind people that there's going to be caucuses after, so don't forget to participate in those. I've been told we have to repeat that. So there'll be a great caucus to continue the discussion that we begin here on strategies and how to act together and combat state repression in a really concrete way after this primary discussion. The caucus will really look at some concrete strategies, so you're welcome to participate in that. That'll be at 6 o'clock. I don't know where.
427.
Room 427. And also those people that are from out of town and don't know where McGill University is, at 6:45, people are meeting down in the lobby to go together towards the building where the panel for this evening will be held. So I'm just going to hand over the show to these guys, and then afterwards we'll begin with the debate and discussion. And keeping in mind that we'd like to maximize participation so that everybody can talk and really look at ways that we can strategize together. Oh, sorry, one more announcement. there's also a urgent action here that Oscar Carrillo, who's the Mexican political refugee here in Montreal for the last 2 years, is asking people to sign, because there's over 500 political prisoners in Mexico today that are on strike, 100 of them on a hunger strike, others that are doing different types of support for this strike, and they would like to know that there are people in other parts of the world that also support in solidarity with this struggle. So before you leave, please sign your name here, and you can read it, the whole context. I won't say more about it. I'll just let people talk then.
I've got one. Yeah, I'll see if I can miss it. I'll turn to the over here.
So, Nandita.
Hi, I'm Nandita Sharma, and I'm with an organization called Open the Borders, which is based in Vancouver in Canada. We recently had a transnational conference in Vancouver that brought together people from around the world to talk specifically about the increased global regime of border controls. And I wanted to kind of frame what's happening in Canada legislatively and on the ground in terms of the effects of the legislative changes, the effects of the greater powers given to police forces, greater power to Immigration Canada, within the global context of what's happening. And I think that we can't really begin any discussion of immigration laws and the everyday lived experience of people who either legally are immigrants or socially are perceived as immigrants within any kind of national state boundary without talking about the fact that we are in a period where international migration is doubling every 10 years. International migration across nationalized borders is increasing twofold every decade, right? So we're in a period right now where immigration is across nationalized borders is twice what it was 10 years ago. And right now, the UN estimates, and I think it's probably a low estimate, that there's approximately 150 million people every year who are crossing nationalized borders. And when we talk about 150 million people every year, we're talking about 1.5 billion people every 10 years. So this is a significant aspect of the experience that people are having of what we now call globalization. And what we need to do, and I think this is something that really needs to be strengthened in terms of those of us who are doing immigrant support work, right, is we need to connect this reality of increased migration across nationalized borders with the reality of displacement. And I think that, for instance, my organization, which is called Open the Borders, interestingly enough, you know, this concept of free movement of people, of workers, is also part of a right-wing agenda. And we need to really be very clear, those of us within the left, within progressive movements, that our agenda of open the borders, in order to actually ensure social justice, any kind of open the borders agenda that is progressive must deal with the issue of displacement, right? Must deal with the fact that what we now call globalization is actually leading to the crisis of migration that I'm talking about. One of the major reasons for displacement is the destruction of the rural economy, right? And there are, the destruction of people's ability to be self-sufficient in rural communities is being destroyed at an unprecedented level. And it's, ideologies that have been developed in the so-called North, the global North, that tell us that there's nothing more backwards in the world than to be a barefooted peasant working with oxen on a small-scale, sustainable, organic farm is part of the process that doesn't allow us to see this crisis of the destruction of the rural economy throughout the world. And that destruction of the rural economy is leading to a massive displacement of people. For instance, the British government right now is funding a project in a state in India called Andhra Pradesh that's estimated to, that is going to displace about 20 million people. Part of the destruction of rural economies and another major aspect of displacement is the development of mega development projects, right? Whether we're talking about hydroelectric dams, whether we're talking about mega projects that are aimed at getting at people's natural resources, that's also leading to a massive amount of displacement, largely from rural communities once again, right? The Three Gorges Dam in China, as hopefully many of you have heard about, is estimated to going to displace about the numbers vary whether you listen to the Chinese government or you listen to people's organizations, anywhere from 2 to 10 million small-scale farmers in China, right? So we're dealing with a situation where the rural economy is being destroyed. The maquiladoras, the factories, the various urban-centered projects that are happening will never, ever be able to meet the needs of the hundreds of millions of people that are being displaced through the destruction of the rural economy, right? We're also dealing in a world where war and militarization is displacing an unprecedented number of people. Afghanistan is one of the largest source countries for refugees, and that's not a coincidence, and that didn't happen just post 9/11. Afghanistan has been the largest producing country of refugee claimants or refugees living outside of their borders for the last 10, 15 years, right? So that process of, once again, the larger analysis of getting at the resources and the strategic position of Afghan people's lands, right? So we're living in a world right now where in order to make sense of what's happening to people who are classified as migrants, as immigrants, we have to connect it to what is broadly called the anti-globalization movement. And the anti-globalization movement has to really come to terms with how processes of globalization are displacing people and therefore causing their movement across nationalized borders. The second thing we have to deal with is the fact that Canada, for example, and the United States and Australia, which these two people will also be talking about, are part of a much larger global system where these negotiations are taking place. You know, Canada is part of international networks, either throughout the Americas, within different networks based in Europe, within different networks based in the Asia-Pacific region, dealing with how these states are going to coordinate their border control activities, right? So that's the other thing we have to talk about. Jean Chrétien recently in Madrid, in the larger focus that the news paid attention to was his comments regarding Palestine. But the other interesting thing about it was that in Madrid, Prime Minister Jean Chrétien talked about how they were working out arrangements in that meeting on how to more speedily deport people from within the member countries that were around that table, right? So the issue of border control is a major issue at all of these international meetings, right? And there are major systems in place to deal with border control. In Canada, we're dealing with a new Immigration Act that's coming into effect in a couple of weeks, Bill C-11, that was based on a previously withdrawn bill that you may have been familiar with. There's a little bit more public attention paid to Bill C-31 than there was to Bill C-11, which is the current new Canada Immigration Act. And what's happening with the Canada Immigration Act is that ultimately it's becoming more and more difficult for people. Remember, we're in the middle of a crisis of international migration, 150 million people every year, right? In the midst of this crisis, what is happening within every single national state in the world is that it's becoming not more difficult to get into that country, right? What is becoming more and more difficult, and this is reflected in Canada's new immigration law, is that it's becoming more and more difficult to actually get immigration status, right? To get permanent resident status. That's the, when I'm talking about border control, that's what I'm talking about, right? Because border control, the way that I think is more realistically the picture, is that border control is completely ideological, right? And I think Monami referred to this in her talk last night, right? That the rhetoric of border control, right, we need order at the border, the borders are out of control, is completely ideological, right? Ideological in the sense that, national states require people who do not have full legal status in order to make profits, right? But it's also ideological, and this is what I want to pay more attention to in my talk. Border control rhetoric is completely ideological because nationalism is a major prop of globalization. And I think that's one thing that, again, those of us in the anti-globalization movement, as it's, you know, very unfortunately known, is one thing that we've ignored, right, is the absolute significance of nationalist projects to processes of globalization and the fact that they've always been important to globalization. There's some parts of the more kind of social democratic left that will tell us that national state sovereignty, nationalism is at odds with processes of globalization, but I think that what is really clear is that nationalism absolutely underpins past, present, and into the future processes of globalization, right? And where the significance comes from is around notions of membership. Right? We've seen since 9/11, and we saw long before 9/11, that ideas of membership that are highly racialized, highly gendered, have played very prominently in people's common sense ideas of who's entitled to what in the world. Right? We get this very detached, incredibly nationalist notion that many of us reproduce in our imaginations and reproduce in our political work, that somehow, for instance, that the welfare states that we have in Canada and Australia, a little bit in the United States, were somehow a project of the hard work of the people who lived inside those national borders, right? Instead of realizing that nation states and ideas of who's entitled to what in the world have always been highly racialized and gendered, and that it's national borders that have actually upheld that racialized and gendered distribution of who gets what in the world, right? So getting back to immigration, what's really interesting about it is that the number of people who have been coming into Canada in the last phase of globalization, right, and the period I want to talk about is basically from the early 1970s to now, right, so which is generally considered this latest period of globalization, right? What's really interesting about that period is that more people than ever have been coming into Canada, right, than in the previous 50 years, right? We haven't seen the kind of numbers of people that are coming into Canada since the end of the First World War, right? So the numbers of people who have been coming into Canada, and Canada is a really good example of this, but it's reproduced around the world, the numbers of people coming into Canada have actually doubled in the 1990s to where they were in the 1980s, to where they were in the 1970s, to where they were in the 1960s, right? The significance of what's been happening in Canada, however, is that the majority of people who are coming into Canada now are either coming in not as permanent residents with landed status, but are either coming in through Canada's migrant workers program, right? The majority of people who are recruited to work in Canada are not given landed status anymore, right? They come in under a temporary indentured workers program called the Non-Immigrant Employment Authorization Program that was begun in 1973, right? The statistics are that in 1973, when that program was first initiated, the majority of people who were recruited to work in Canada were given landed status, right? Around 60% in 1973 were given landed status. And I'm not even bringing in undocumented people into the picture here yet, and I will later on. In 1973, so the majority are being given landed status. By the beginning of the 1990s, 20 years later, 75% of all people that the Canadian government was recruiting to work in Canada were coming in as temporary migrant indentured workers, and only 25% were being given permanent residency status. And that's the significance of changes in immigration policy worldwide. It's been estimated that one-third of all of those 150 million people that are crossing nationalized borders are crossing them as temporary indentured migrant workers, right? And the reality in the world today is that every single nation state in the world is either a labor sending or a labor receiving country. Every single country in the world is relying upon processes of migration and obviously therefore processes of displacement, right? And, you know, as, you know, a lot of the anti-globalization movement has been focusing on the processes of displacement without properly calling them processes of displacement, you know, the mega development projects, the maquiladoras, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But that process of globalization that we've been focusing on leads to the other absolutely pivotal piece of globalization, which is the migration piece, right? And how border control rhetoric has served not to actually physically exclude people, and that is absolutely what it is not meant to do, as Monami had mentioned in her talk last night, right? It is not meant to restrict people's entry. What it's meant to do is restrict their status once they're in, and we really need to get that very clear when we talk about immigration and globalization. Right, so you know the picture in Canada right now with Bill C-11 is that it's become even more difficult in the year 2002 to get landed status in this country than ever before, right? And we're in a period right now where the only people, as many of us have heard, the only people essentially who will be given landed status in Canada any longer are either going to come in through the business and entrepreneur program, right, or they're going to be accredited university educated people. So even the people who were previously let into the point system as of, you know, last year, well, they will no longer receive landed status either. Right? That doesn't mean that the processes of displacement have stopped. They're actually increasing, right? They're doubling every 10 years. It just means that there's going to be fewer and fewer recourses around the world as those people are moving to ever get landed status anywhere, right? And the scope of the people that's going to affect is increasing, as we've seen with Bill C-11, right? Now, the other side of the picture is another issue that I've been working on in Vancouver is the issue of undocumented peoples, right? And particularly undocumented peoples who have been smuggled into Canada, right? They're, you know, by people variously named traffickers, snakeheads, you know, so on and so forth. All of those terms I really disagree with, and I'll tell you why. What's really interesting, I worked with the 599 people who came on the four boats from China to the west coast of British Columbia in the summer of 1999. And I'm sure that many of you who were in Canada at that time and were looking at the corporate-owned media's account of that, there was a complete moral panic constructed about the effects that these 599 people were going to have on the character of Canadian society, right? And what was really interesting about that was that as the crisis of displacement continues unchecked and is actually increasing every year through processes of globalization, right? As the crisis of migration across nationalized borders also doubles every 10 years, as globally governments restrict the ability not of people to move but of them to get landed status, right? We see the United Nations, we see the Canadian government through Bill C-11, we see the United States government, the Australian government, and so on and so forth, saying that we really need to tackle this international crime problem of trafficking, right, and of people smuggling. And isn't this terrible, and don't we really need to crack down on these people? Bill C-11 authorizes the Canadian state to give a life sentence. There's not that many crimes in Canada that you can actually be put to jail for a life sentence, right? This is one of them through Bill C-11. Bill C-11 authorizes the state to ultimately give a life sentence to those people who are convicted of people smuggling. In the United States, it's very similar. There's even some cases in the United States where the death penalty applies to people who are doing people smuggling, right? And when I was working around the issue of people from China on the boats in 1999, what was really troubling is that not only the United Nations, not only the various governments, North and South, but also people's organizations are also taking up this this language of we have to stop the smugglers, we have to stop the traffickers, right? Without simultaneously, and I would agree that a lot of these people are not friends of migrants, although some of them definitely are. Some people do absolutely help to smuggle people, sometimes for money, but to great personal risk of themselves, right? And basically at a cost recovery type. I mean, there's very many well documented empirical cases of people helping people move across nationalized borders at great personal risk, but some of them definitely are total scuzzbags, absolutely, right? But for us to say that we need to tackle the problem of smuggling, tackle the problem of so-called trafficking, which is a term I really deplore, and I can talk about that later if you want, but without us dealing with that issue, without us moving people in our movements are not moving people, right? Our movements also need to start engaging in moving people, right? And what I always like to remind people is that Harriet Tubman, who ran the Underground Railroad that ended in Windsor, Ontario, was a people smuggler, right? And under U.S. and Canadian law would be put in jail for the rest of her life. Right, we need to follow her example in our movement. We need to move people, and that's definitely a strategy. Obviously, a great personal risk. You know, we're talking about serious jail time here, if not death penalties. We need to talk internationally. This is one of the areas of strategizing that we really need to seriously focus on in terms of our movements around immigration. So there's been this, incredible, when you look at the landscape of trying to do social justice work for migrants, right, it's a pretty tough case, right, because you're talking about, increased displacement, increased migration, increased restrictions on who gets landed status, and then the only existing avenue for people to bypass that system, which is smuggling, right, is also one of the major targets of international crime prevention, according to the United Nations, right? The whole issue of people smuggling falls under that avenue of international crime that the United Nations has developed, right? And now, post-911, we are dealing with a situation where the state has given itself greater power to determine who can and who cannot cross borders. In terms of what's going to happen to them once they arrive, right? And I think that, the first point that I made that we need to get back to, particularly to make sense of why in Canada, in the United States, post-911 has meant in one of its major planks, right, the reality of what we're dealing with after September the 11th has meant greater and greater attacks against people of color, right? And we need to understand the importance of nationalism in that, right? Because all of the post-911 rhetoric in Canada and the United States has been the defense of the nation, right? We've got the Homeland Security Minister, Tom Ridge in the United States. We've got John Manley taking unprecedented powers here in Canada, you know, in terms of the discussion of protecting Canadian security and Canadian economy. We've seen the military budgets of Canada rise to levels unprecedented. We've seen the U.S. budget rise to huge numbers, all in the name of defense of the nation. And when we're talking about defense of the nation, right, we have to be very clear to deconstruct what that rhetoric is all about, right? And part of what the rhetoric of defense of the nation is defense of the people who are seen as members of the nation. This is nothing about de facto legal status of who is and who does not have citizenship status, right? It's really about, once again, reorganizing a world where certain groups of people are seen as entitled to the lands and the resources and the wealth and the labor of the other vast majority of that world. And one of the ways that that's been reorganized post 911 is through nationalism and through nationalist rhetoric. And immigration policy is the pivotal flashpoint at determining who does and who does not belong to the nation. And that's why immigration policy changes, rhetoric around immigration figures so prominently in any kind of post 911 discussion, right? And what that does, you know, it is obviously a major aspect is ensuring people's vulnerability, right? Once the majority of the people who are coming into any nationalized state are not given status, are not given legal status, the state has organized their vulnerability, right? By classifying people as migrant workers, which is, you know, the state is doing this. It's not people themselves who are classifying themselves as indentured migrant workers. It's not people themselves who are classifying themselves as illegal. This is the state that is doing this. This is the state that is ensuring that their labor is cheapened, that their ability to organize and protect themselves is weakened. Right? This is the state doing this, because oftentimes I hear a very essentialist discourse, right? All these people are coming in and they're cheap labor and blah, 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 right? They're less likely to organize, et cetera, without any discussion of how the state actually organizes their cheapness and their weakness, right? So the state is organizing these people's incredible vulnerability. So it is obviously about protecting the profits and the power of employers. It's obviously about that. It's obviously about protecting the power and the profits of landlords, right? It's obviously about further empowering police forces, right? If people are migrant workers, in Canada, if you're a migrant worker on a farm, if you're a migrant farm worker, which Ontario has you know, many tens of thousands of people working in that situation, it is illegal for you to go off the property of the farm owner. Right? Incredible vulnerability is organized through the state for many people who are classified without full legal status, right? So it's obviously about ensuring their vulnerability, but what it's also about is actually protecting the state, right? In the name of the nation, right? In the name of the Canadian government, for example, protecting the Canadian nation, which, as we know, through our personal lived experiences as well as through our research, that idea of membership is highly racialized, highly gendered, right? But through the protection of the nation, what the state is actually doing is protecting itself, right? And what it, you know, what we need to do, I think, as organizers and particularly those of us who are members of communities who are under attack, what we really need to do is that's what we need to target, right? Is really target the ideological nature of the border control rhetoric, really show how any kind of nationalist discourse that's propping up the state in terms of the nation is part of that larger processes of globalization that we're also fighting against, right? And that's why I think, like, taking a position that, you know, our organization, Open the Borders, could very well have been called End Displacement, right? But I do believe that it's important for people to be able to move through their own self-determination. So any kind of end displacement displacement, open the borders, politics, strategy, language, I think ultimately is amongst the most revolutionary stances that we can take in the world right now, because I think it's that part of the movement that's really getting to the heart of the issue, which for me is that national states have grown hand in hand with global capitalism, right? These are not two separate systems. So when we're talking about people's self-determination, when we're talking about protecting our communities, right, which obviously I believe very strongly that we ought to be doing, right, we really need to de-link nation from community, right, and we need to de-link national states from homes, right? And if we're not able to do that, we're never going to achieve social justice for migrants, because it's exactly at that turning, at that border crossing, right, of non-members crossing into the nationalized territories of the members of the nation, that we get all of the injustices that are done, particularly to third world peoples, right? And that's why I think like an open the borders and displacement kinds of politics is really at the crux of the issue of you know, for lack of a better term, I know this has been thrown around for a couple of decades now, but white capitalist patriarchy, right? Is really getting at the heart of it, because I don't see how we're going to succeed by simply asking for fairer immigration policies, right? I don't see how we're going to succeed if the best we can do is say we need to expand the definition of refugee, which obviously I believe we need to do, but if we just stop there, I don't see how we're going to achieve social justice, right? If we just stop at the point of where we say we end displacement, right, without ensuring the destruction of the national state system, it's not going to happen, right? So this whole questioning of something that is so firmly ingrained in our imaginations, right, I am a member of this or that national state, my liberation lies in nationalist movements. If we cannot de-link nation from community and we cannot de-link national state from home, we're not going to win the struggle for social justice for migrants, and we're not going to win the social justice movement for seeing the end of globalization, as we've been calling it, right? And globalization in this respect really is the kind of global reach of very narrow interests. That's what globalization is, right? Is the global reach of very narrow interests, right? And we're not going to succeed if all we have to respond with is one nationalist movement or another, right? Propping up one national state or another, or perhaps even creating new national states in the name of liberation, right? Because this hasn't worked for us, right? So I think that I will end it there. I think I've run out of time, and I hope it wasn't too scattered, but I'd be happy to answer questions afterwards.
Okay, just to follow on from Nandita, my name is Aziz Chaudhry. I'm based in Aotearoa, New Zealand, but what I'm mainly going to focus on now is talking about Australia. And I should say that that's not because of any real sense that the situation in New Zealand is so much better, because in fact there's a bit of a US-Canada thing often with a lot of talk about policy issues and things like that, that sometimes liberal people in Canada say, oh, well, we're so much better than US, and likewise in New Zealand there's that sort of tendency as well. But I guess one of the questions that I wanted to start off asking was, whose borders are they anyway? Because when Nandita was involved with organising Open the Borders in Vancouver, I was at a small meeting in Adelaide in Australia called Borderlines just before a big mobilisation against the concentration camp in the desert for people who have come in. And I used the word concentration camp. It's not a throwaway line. That's what they are. These are a subsidiary of Wacken Hut ACM, Australasian Correctional Management, that runs private detention centres for people that are entering into Australia without papers. Anyway, just here are a couple of cartoons that were done. This one was done the top one here was done in 1988, which was the year that White Australia celebrated its bicentennial. And you have two Indigenous people standing on the shore there saying, "Oh no, international terrorists." And there's some people down the front there on the shore with a boat in the background planting a flag. I'm not sure. Do you recognise that flag? It's got... I think they call it Union Jack, yeah. But anyway, the people that plant it, the people that used to go around the world and plant it, and they said, well, everything that I can see, I will claim for king or queen, someone or other. And this one down here was one that was done more recently, which relates to what's going on now and links, I guess, back to the fact that Australia, like Canada and Aotearoa New Zealand, is a white settler colonial state. And you have an Indigenous guy here saying to somebody else with that thing again, that Jack of all trades thing, saying, I'm afraid this state-of-the-art olfactory tracking device is mandatory until your refugee status can be assessed with this kind of rotting sheep carcass on this colonizer's head. And it's kind of, I guess, in terms of some of the work that I've done as an activist that's worked on Indigenous sovereignty issues, as an activist that also has roots back in South Asia, and as an activist that works on corporate globalization, is to be looking at, I guess, some of the connections and some of the links in the different, well, what may seem to be different campaigns, but in fact I think are intimately linked. And I was showing Jaggi Singh earlier this thing that I brought up from a New Zealand newspaper, which is Boat People Invade Australia. You know, this article came out last year, but it was about 200 and something years too late, because, you know, I'm not going to quote Celine Dion, honestly. I know when I come here, my Canadian friends get really into my obsession with Celine Dion and bad Canadian music. But I will quote a very good Indigenous Australian activist, singer-songwriter, Kev Carmody, who said in 1788 down Sydney Cove, I won't sing it, the first boat people landed. They said, "Sorry, boys, your gains are lost. We're going to steal your land." And so I find it really interesting now looking at what's going on in Australia with not only with the policy of mandatory detention for people that are coming into Australia from countries like Iraq, from Afghanistan and so on, and their so-called Pacific solution, which I'll talk about in a minute, by trying to get countries in the Pacific that are now essentially being used as these kind of dumping grounds for unwanted people like Nauru, like Papua New Guinea. I find it very interesting watching these people who are essentially creating this sort of, as Nandita was saying, about this sort of construct of the nation being the white Australian nation, suddenly deciding who can come in and out of, well, not that they're suddenly deciding it, this has been going on for a long time, but giving themselves the right to decide who comes in and who goes out and who gets to be deemed to be Australian or assimilatable enough to come into the country. And I guess to me it seems to me that there's a similar dynamic here in terms of Canada, in terms of this whole arrogance of colonizer settler governments, which is what they still are, to actually say, we can do all this stuff and anyway, not even make any acknowledgement of the fact that the land and the resources that these governments are also benefiting from is stolen. And that's it, plain and simple. This is stolen land. Australia is stolen land. Aotearoa New Zealand is stolen land. And the US too is stolen land. So I find it really, that's a kind of an irony to begin with. And I think that in that there is also some opportunities for some of us that do come from or have our sort of background in other places in third world or whatever, to actually be looking at some of the alliances and some of the commonalities among our struggles, both whether they're within the societies we're living in or looking at the dynamics that are impacting on the societies that maybe our families have moved from, and looking at alliances with Indigenous people, because I think there have been some really quite interesting stuff that's happened in Australia where we've seen prominent Aboriginal activists saying, yeah, well, this, looking at the concentration camps for the people that are being held there, and saying, yeah, well, this is exactly the way we have been treated for the last 200 years, and we are just like these people in here, essentially. And actually, there's been some good outspoken people that have said, you know, that have actually come out and said some very important things, I think, in making those connections. I should also stress too, and I think this is also relevant to the Canadian situation, that the current system of mandatory detention in Australia came in under a so-called centre-left government. It came in 1992. It was the Labor government that brought that in. It's not something that's happened since September 11. It's something that has been going on for a long time. And I know here sometimes there's this sort of dynamic here about kind of, well, the NDP will fix everything. And certainly, you know, I mean, it seems to me that, you know, there's a saying, if you'll excuse my terribly vulgar language, you know, same shit, different piles, basically, in terms of how this has been approached. And it's also interesting looking at in 92, the fact that that same year when Australia was looking at recession, there was unemployment growing, you had, on the one hand, this mandatory detention scheme, mandatory detention for people that didn't come in with papers being set up, and all of these what are now privately run, Wackenhut subsidiary owned and run camps in the desert, in the outback, in areas extremely, you know, so-called inhospitable, at the same time you saw an increasing embrace by Australia and advocacy for free trade and free investment, as they call it. And it's very, you know, I mean, I've just been looking at some of this stuff recently, at looking at, on one level, Australian foreign affairs and trade policy, where they're looking at engagement with the Indian Ocean Rim countries, and on the other hand, looking at how they treat people that are coming in from Indian Ocean Rim countries who arrive there without documentation. And then also how that flows on to the communities that already exist in Australia of people that come from those countries, especially, obviously, since September 11. Last time I was in Montreal, I talked to the South Asian Women's Community Centre here about the sort of the, I don't really want to call it backlash, but the what had happened basically in the Pacific and in Australia and New Zealand in relation to the sort of the September 11 events. And what had happened just prior to my coming up and prior to September 11 had been that a Norwegian freighter called the Tampa, and I don't know if people are familiar with this story, I'm not really aware of the level of coverage and so on that has been there, was intercepted by the Australian Navy. The Australian Armed Forces now, you know what their functions are? Apart from going over to Afghanistan and fighting with all the other forces that are there, with Tony Blair's mob and George Bush's mob and Chrétien's mob that seems to be digging up graves and being really excited about finding, you know, dead bodies at the moment and so on. What the Navy's function is basically patrolling the Indian Ocean coast and keeping out people that are trying to come in, mainly from Indonesia, on boats. I mean, it's a really serious military operation. And these Navy people are also backed up by the SAS, the Special Armed Service people. There have been reports of people being beaten up, brutalised by Australian armed forces, which of course are strenuously denied. And so even before September 11, you had a boatload of mainly Afghani people that are coming in, and you already had this sort of paranoia and this whipping up of this sentiment against these people, as they're called. They're called these people. This is what people are referred to now, is just these people, the politicians talk about. And the entire election in November last year in Australia was won. Seriously, the so-called asylum seeker issue was what John Howard's government won the election on. And again, if you look at the Labor opposition, they were just essentially arm wrestling to say who could be tougher, who's going to be tougher with these people, who's going to be meaner and show the world that Australia was not a soft touch for these people smugglers and these people that are coming in. And again, like Nandita's saying, there's been a lot of focus on this people smuggling in Australia. They've been talking about queue jumpers, the people that are coming in. In the global context, what Australia, the number of people going into Australia is just nothing. I mean, you know, I've been in Pakistan, I've seen the numbers, and this was going years ago, the numbers of people that are in refugee camps that have been there for years. And suddenly the West has only just discovered, it seems, in the last few years, last few months, that, oh, there's all these millions of people in Pakistan and Iran. And so when you hear words like, you know, boat people invading Australia, and when you hear about invasion, and even Philip Ruddock, the Minister for Minister for Multicultural Affairs, Immigration and Indigenous Affairs, which is kind of an interesting mix. He's the guy that is one of the main players, I guess, in terms of this politically there. And when you hear him talking about words like national emergency, which is a word that he used in 1999, to describe the numbers of people coming in, you can see just how this is really being hyped. This is really being hyped up, because the reality is, of course, geographically, compared with the numbers of people that are able to get to Europe and to North America and so on, Australia is not getting anything like an invasion of people. Then, of course, there is a real. I think there's a really interesting issue if we're looking at sort of the specifics to Australia. It's ironic that in the 1860s the British brought out people from what's modern day Afghanistan, India, Middle East to open up the outback, the camel herders. Now a lot of Australians don't even know this history. It's sort of been written out of the history books until recently. And when I was in Adelaide 6 weeks ago, and down at the railway station in Adelaide, I saw the GAN, as they call it in Australia, the GAN. Now, the GAN is short for Afghan. And this is the train that runs from, the GAN runs from Adelaide, it runs from Adelaide to Alice Springs, and essentially that is, that for want of a better, I mean, that's essentially been how, in many, the only sort of legacy that for of that whole history, a forgotten history of what essentially people from that part of the world did for the Australian nation, as it was. It's kind of interesting now, you know, how that kind of gets forgotten too. And in fact, again, looking at sort of continuity towards the old style, this idea that things have just, I mean, yeah, September 11 obviously has intensified things and given governments chances to bring in legislation and do all kinds of things, but let's not kid ourselves that this was anything that wasn't happening before. Australia had a white Australia policy, then it had an assimilation policy. In the 1990s it thought multiculturalism was kind of a cool way to get their goods into economies in Asia and saying, hey, we're a multicultural society, we like Asian people sometimes, we like it, you know, when we have this kind of festival in Sydney or something, it's kind of neat having, you know, some people doing some singing and dancing and stuff, and there's some really nice Lebanese food down the road here too and that, so, yeah. But now, since 1996, that's kind of changed a little bit, that dynamic has changed a little bit in the sense that they have gone, if you like, because of the Conservative government, they have kind of backed off this sort of, we are part of Asia, which I think Paul Keating, the Labor Prime Minister, talked about in the early 1990s. But they've got this great initiative called Supermarket to Asia. Now, what they Supermarket to Asia? They want a supermarket to Asia, but they don't want people that are coming in from Asian countries that are often leaving as a result of regimes that Australia either has in the past or still does support. They don't want that. So there's always that kind of conflict, I guess, between when you look at the economic policies and you look at the rhetoric about open borders and you look at the rhetoric about, you know, global village and all this, when it comes down to it, you know, there's nothing of the sort. But last year, I mean, there are any number of disgusting examples of how outright lies have been told by politicians to essentially sort of build up this this fear of invasion, this invasion paranoia. And I think, again, the invasion paranoia can be linked back to the fact that, yes, white settlers in Australia are invaders themselves. I think there is something in the colonial white settler psyche, if you like, that does have a bearing on this. And in 1890s, there was a journalist who was giving evidence to Western Australia's Parliament about the Afghan problem. Afghan, I get my accents right. My accents are mixed up, it's not funny. Afghan problem. Gilbert Probyn-Smith, he said in 1894, the problem was because there were Afghans that were taking food into the food supply chains into this gold rush area called Coolgardie in Western Australia. And he said, yeah, the problem is that many were still in sympathy with those Afghans who fought the British during the Second Afghan War. They were traitorous by nature. And he warned of the peril, this is a direct quote, he warned of the peril to Australian lives if a jihad were to be proclaimed somewhere in the Muslim world. And now, you know, just last year, the Defence Minister in Australia, Peter Reith, he claimed that the unauthorised arrival of boats on Australian territory, quote, can be a pipeline for terrorists to come in and use your country as a staging post for terrorist activities. And so along with all of this sort of stuff, there's also been the equivalent of CSIS, the Asian Security Intelligence Organisation, the New Zealand Security Intelligence Service in New Zealand, that have been going into communities that they decide are, you know, somehow going to be national security threats, and we can all guess who they're going to be. And you know, they don't tend to go to the overstayers from Britain and Canada and the States, who tend to be actually the numerical majority in those countries of people who are so-called overstayers. Because if you read the government line on immigration, they say that, I mean, there's this thing I got from the Australian Ministry of Immigration. It says here that all unlawful non-citizens who are in Australia must be detained. And unless they are granted permission to remain on Australia, they must be removed from Australia as soon as practicable. But when you look at Woomera and you look at Curtin and you look at all of the other detention centres, so-called, in Australia, it's funny that they're not full of British people or Canadians or, you know, Americans, even though if you want to take that analysis, those people have always been the people, as far as, you know, overstayers, as far as visas go, have been the overstayers in that. The visitors from those countries, and so, yeah, I mean, there's been that. There's also been a lot of resistance that I think is really important to note, that has come from inside the centres and not just outside the centres, because a lot of the liberal groups in Australia present this kind of thing that, oh, they're organising, they're concerned about the refugees being treated this way, but in fact, like I think somebody was saying this morning about, you know, maybe in States or Canada as well, you know, there's been resistance from the word go. I mean, those people have been actively playing a role in their in seeking a safer life, a better life for them and their families, and to construct them as they've been done by both sometimes people on the left and the right as being kind of, you know, passive victims or kind of that need our help sort of thing, or kind of, you know, evil sleepers for Al-Qaeda or whatever the latest stereotype is, then that's nonsensical. And so recently, over Easter, in Woomera, which is in the South Australian desert, there was a major mobilisation. Friends of mine were involved with organising this kind of convergence on Woomera, which is one of the biggest detention centres there, and they basically, people from inside and outside, brought down some of the fences. And to my knowledge, as of when I left, there were still 12 people who had been held inside that concentration camp, who were, who'd basically been whisked to safety outside. They're still out, and hopefully, you know, will still stay
out, because there were a lot of people were able to escape and get out. And I mean, the conditions in those camps are absolutely disgusting. You have this same, and again, going back to Australia's colonial sort of history, you have this obsession with locking people up if they're a certain kind of people. And Australia at the moment is locking up a hell of a lot of people that are coming in, either in Australian territory, or now what they're trying to do is say, no, if you land on Australia, you can't actually claim any kind of status in Australia. You're not going to have you here. You'll go off to Manus Island in Papua New Guinea, which is an old Papua New Guinea Navy base, which the Australian College of Physicians put out a media release about a couple of months ago, saying this is outrageous that people are being kept here, where there's a very dangerous and high risk of contracting malaria, where people have been lied to. Basically, people have thought they were going to Australia. They found out they're actually imprisoned on a Pacific island away from anywhere. Where you've already got countries like Papua New Guinea that are suffering under structural adjustment policies that have been dumped on by Australia and New Zealand in the sort of the junior subcontractor kind of role that they play for Western imperialism in the South Pacific, where you have already internally issues of displaced people with the West Papuan refugees, who Australia always used to take this line that West Papuan refugees weren't, this is all an internal dispute inside of Indonesia. The West Papuan community activists, some of the independence activists came out and they spoke very strongly about in support of the people that were coming in from Afghanistan and Iraq, but they also pointed out the fact that, Australia had taken this line in the Pacific when activists from the Pacific independence struggles had been forced to flee their countries, and that often they were just, put on a terrorist kind of blacklist and weren't able to come in. And so that resistance and that movement, I think, in Australia is quite similar. There are some quite similar strands in terms of the sort of the open borders discussions that are taking place there. Back in New Zealand, where I live, the issue is kind of because of the demographics, it's quite different in terms of the numbers relatively of people coming in. If you look at the numbers, you think, oh, it's not very much. But remember, we're talking about a country of 3.9 million people. And still, if you come into New Zealand and you don't have papers, you get locked up. If they catch you, you get locked up in Mount Eden Prison, which is this Victorian shambles, which is just a disgusting, hole, or put into a secure unit in the Mangere Reception Centre for the refugee, the migrant reception centre in South Auckland. And again, there has been that. And again, like somebody was saying yesterday, I think it's wrong to use the term backlash, because it assumes that people from South Asian or Muslim communities have actually done anything to be, lashed against. There has been, a part and parcel of whipping up all of this hatred and hysteria around the sort of the so-called invasion of the asylum seekers has been that there has been a backlash against communities that have been there for a long time, you hear lots of stories, or the same kind of stories that we hear in the States, of Sikh taxi drivers getting hassled, mosques getting graffitied and targeted. There were two mosques, I think, that were one was burnt down in Brisbane, and I think there was another arson attack. Kids getting hassled on the way to school, and so that flow over into, if you like, the established good, immigrants that have been trying to fit in to Australia and New Zealand society and so on. Suddenly, we're all kind of like suspect, sleepers for whoever it is, Bin Laden or something like that. I actually think that that's, it's a real thing. Somebody was saying yesterday it's like a slap in the face for a lot of, longer standing immigrant communities, that suddenly they realised, they thought they'd been accepted and it was okay and all that, and suddenly, it's comments at work, or it's jokes about, Bin Laden, or it's, kind of something worse than that, obviously the what's been happening in the States with the disappearances, that sort of stuff that's been going down, and again, I think that goes back to some of the stuff that Nandita was talking about, the constructs of, the nation state, And again, I think, you know, we have to look at too the links and the connections between immigration in all of its forms and colonization, because immigration and colonization have always gone, things part and parcel of you know, they've been very, very related. Whether you're looking at you know, getting so-called cheap labor into Western countries, and who benefit, you know, all of the questions about who benefits and so on, or whether you're looking at the way that countries or dominant, you know, governments kind of construct and perpetuate their kind of image of themselves. And it's interesting, just on the plane up from Australia and from New Zealand, I just sort of finished with this. Philip Ruddock, who seems to be big on declaring what is and isn't Australian, because he has said various things about people that have been coming in from Iraq and Afghanistan, this is very un-Australian behaviour. When there have been protests within the detention centres, this is very un-Australian. When the Australian government completely fabricated the claims that children were thrown overboard, Iraqi asylum seekers were throwing kids overboard a boat last year, it was totally fabricated and essentially helped them win the election. He was saying, oh, this is un-Australian. And John Howard, the Prime Minister, saying, oh, yeah, I mean, this is just, you know, We wouldn't do that sort of stuff here. And when people who had been on hunger strike were sewing their lips together because this was one way they could make sure they weren't going to be force-fed and so on, when they were on hunger strike inside the Curtin centres and some of these other detention centres, again, you had all this un-Australian stuff and all of this rubbish that was saying somehow this was implying this was a cultural practice. I mean, for God's sake, which culture in the world... Which culture in the world is going to do that unless there's something really desperate and really serious situation going on? Ruddock announced that next year they're going to have this big immigration push, and they're going to have 105,000 target for bringing in new migrants into Australia. They'll keep the refugee numbers at 12,000, which is their standard quota, and it'll be really interesting to see what the breakdown of that 105,000 new immigrants is, where they come from, how much money they bring in, and on what basis that they come in. Because there was this, and I don't know if it's been the same here, there's been this thing recently, you know, the Commonwealth had its circus, that CHOGM meeting in Brisbane a few weeks ago, and you know, I don't know what Canada's position was, but Australia and New Zealand were going, oh, you know, Zimbabwe, you know, really bad human rights, and we like human rights in our countries, so we should kick Mugabe out and blah blah blah. And I'm not going to sit here and defend Mugabe, but it's, you know, you have this total hypocrisy on the part of these governments that are instituting the same repressive legislation, anti-terrorist legislation, immigration kinds of legislation, and on the other hand, you have this lobby within Australia and New Zealand, and coming from quite significant sectors in big business at some stage, saying, oh yeah, but we should let the white farmers from Zimbabwe come in under refugee status. It's outrageous that these people don't come in, because, you know, these people, you know, they would fit in really well in a country like New Zealand or Australia. But the irony, of course, is a lot of these people are actually coming in as business migrants. They can come in as business migrants. They don't need to come in as refugees then. And in fact, in Australia and New Zealand, frankly, there are enough, if you like, homegrown racists there without more of these. Although we have a fair quota of South African cops, you know, there are a few of them around, and a couple of ex-RUC guys who've arrested me and stuff like that. You know, we have that sort of international flavour in the police force too. But there is this sort of thing. We had one MP going, well, the Somalis shouldn't be here because they're desert races and they don't fit in. But he was the same guy that was actually sort of making a case, I think, that the white farmers in Zimbabwe, I think they're like the real Africans or something, is that right? That the Zimbabwe white farmers are the real Africans, and everybody that's really African isn't really African or something like that. I think that's how it works these days. So, yeah. But anyway, I've kind of skipped all over the place, but I wanted to sort of give a sense of, I guess, some of the dynamics and some of the things that are being discussed and some of the things that are happening there. I have, I mean, I've got sort of information that, I mean, if people can, I mean, I'm happy to talk about it too, and I mean, I've got other stuff with me that I'd be happy to sort of share with people. So anyway, thanks.
Wow. Okay. How much time do I have? Okay. Let me talk fast.
Don't forget, we have a coffee after, so we can continue talking about strategy and stuff like that.
No problem. Let me introduce myself briefly. My name is Subhash Katil. I'm from an organization called Drum, Desi's Rising Up and Moving, from New York City. A lot of people were in the last workshop, so forgive me. I just still have to introduce myself to other people that don't know who the hell I am. Our organization has been doing work for the past 2 years on immigrant detention in the United States, and what we tend to call the growth of immigrant apartheid in America. And you know, there's been a lot of common themes and a lot of common issues. And I guess where I'll start off is I'll just start talking about this term immigrant apartheid, like more in detail, and you know, the growth of immigrant apartheid more in detail as it applies to, you know, brothers and sisters in the South Asian community, the Arab community, the Muslim community that we've been working with, and other immigrant communities of color that we've been working with. You know, it starts with a basic question: what is apartheid? You know, and everyone knows what apartheid was in South Africa. Everyone is, you know, seeing every day what, you know, how violent forms of apartheid play themselves out, you know, in Palestine right now. And basically, apartheid is something in which people can occupy different legal categories of human beings based on who they are. In a very basic way, is that you become legally different from other human beings because of who you are, because you happen to be black, or because you happen to be Palestinian, or because, in this case, you happen to be an immigrant. And that's what we're seeing the development of, not just in the United States, but in plenty of first world countries, where you're seeing the growth of institutions that are enforcing this form of apartheid on human beings based on immigration status. And I mean, for folks that were in the last workshop and for folks that weren't, you know, as we said, since September 11th, 1,200 to 2,000 people in Arab, South Asian, and Muslim communities have been detained, in addition to the 25,000 or so immigrants, mostly immigrants of color, that would be in INS detention, be detained by Immigration and Naturalization Service in America on any given day, and in line with the tens of thousands of people that are deported every year that were immigrants in America. Now, you know, we were visiting hundreds of brothers and sisters locked up, and the reality of it was they would not be there if they were citizens. So they would see sunlight if they were citizens, and, you know, they would be outside if they were citizens, and they'd be talking to the families if they were citizens. They wouldn't have to collect calls from jail if they were citizens in that brief period of time. That the whole process of dehumanization and criminalization happened because they were not citizens. And the way that plays itself out in the day-to-day life of immigrant communities of color in America and in other parts of the world is growing. Any walk into an immigration office in the United States, and when you come across metal detectors, you come across bulletproof glass protecting you from the person that's cursing you out and asking you why you can't speak English, as they're working in the Immigration and Naturalization Service office of the INS, of the Justice Department, walking into a social welfare office to try to get refugee benefits, and being confronted once again with bulletproof glass and with security guards and with metal detectors and with people asking you why you can't speak English and why did you come to this country and did you come here illegally and things like that. Basic trips to the library, basic trips to school where you're stopped and asked for your ID and you're asked for your immigration status by police, by men with guns and bulletproof vests and things like that. So the day-to-day life of immigrants of color, of third world peoples living in first world countries, becomes one where it's okay that they occupy different categories of human beings. This all becomes legal. As I said before, we had the 1996 laws, which allowed whole categories of human beings to be detained strictly because they were immigrants. And so like I just said, this plays itself out in different areas of life. It plays itself out in terms of incarceration rates, in terms of the growth of incarceration rates in immigrant communities, and the growth of an INS presence in immigrant communities, and the growth of cooperation with the immigration police, with the Immigration and Naturalization Service, and the NYPD, and the New York City Police Department. Excuse me, I keep throwing out these acronyms as if everyone knows what they mean. But, you know, the growth of cooperation between the Immigration and Naturalization Service and the police department. And then in public education, for example, the growth of cooperation between immigration and the school board, between immigration and school officials and teachers. In social services, and the growth of cooperation between immigration and the welfare office. And so you literally have... If you start drawing profiles of people and you start, you know, taking different stories of people, you have one human being who may be white, middle class, and citizen, and one person, and this is the example I put out the most to people just to give you an idea of how different lives can be in a place like America in a system of apartheid and how we may not realize it. You go to the state of Texas, you take one human being who's middle class and white or upper middle class and white who gets caught drunk driving. Assuming he gets caught drunk driving. Assuming he drives his own car. And he gets caught drunk driving. He does two or three weeks in jail, 2 months in jail, whatever. After the time he does in jail, once again, assuming he does time in jail, he goes out and he gets to kiss his family and goes on to become president, right? Now, you have a similar situation in the state of Texas, right, where you have a low-income person of color who's a non-citizen. Or let's not even go that far. He's a legal permanent resident. He has a green card. You know, he's a legal immigrant who gets caught drunk driving, right, and does more than 2 weeks in jail. Let's say he does a whole month in jail. Well, in the state of Texas, that's a deportable offense. So after a month in jail... he goes to jail again, this time because he's not a citizen. If he decides to fight his immigration case, he can spend as much as 2 months, 3 months, sometimes a year, sometimes 2 years. If he happens to be Palestinian or Libyan and, you know, Israel or Libya won't take him back, he could be in there indefinitely for drunk driving in the state of Texas. And there's another guy that got to go out and kiss his family and become president in the same state. They could have lived... a half mile apart from each other. So we all know now there's a form of immigrant apartheid in America, and this is part of a system of apartheid that's always operated in the global context. If you deal with colonialism, the history of colonialism, the history of racism, capitalism, patriarchy, basically where you had the a history in which a bunch of people from a place called Europe left Europe. Either they left Europe or they sent another group of people to go leave Europe and go take a bunch of money, a bunch of other stuff from another group of people in other parts of the world, in India, in Africa, and the Caribbean, right? And so when colonialism was over and when people effectively kicked these same groups of people out of their countries, they still stayed in the form of the World Bank, in the form of the IMF, in the form of military bases, whatnot. And you see this huge concentration of wealth forming that spreads from the third world to the first world, or if you live within the first world, from third world communities to first world communities in America, in Canada, in Europe. And then you see people's reaction to it. In third world countries, you see people acting upon the situation of economic violence and political violence and acting upon the fact that while you have wealth flowing from third world countries to first world countries, from poor countries to rich countries, from poor people to rich people, you have poverty flowing to third world countries. You have violence flowing to third world countries. Why? Because, you know, guns are part of free, you know, are part of free trade, and, you know, and military aid to states that are violent is part of free trade. So when groups of people decide to act upon that and leave, and act upon that and go to countries that it took from them and actively take back. The reason I stated like this is I stated in terms of reparations, and I stated in terms of what is owed to third world peoples, given the process of colonialism, given the process of racism, and given the global roots of why immigration takes place, right? when people go to take back or to leave situations of violence, whether it be political or economic, that were created, that have their roots in first world power, they're confronted with apartheid once again. They're confronted with detention. They're confronted with jail. They're confronted with officers asking for your papers. They're confronted with the inability to go to college in some cases. They're confronted with the inability to get social services, right? But then there's this other need. There's this need of people in the first world for cheap labor in any way, shape, or form that it comes about, whether it's in sweatshops in the third world or whether it's sweatshops filled with third world people in the first world. It you know, plays out in all sorts of different types of ways, right? So you have this situation, and then in this situation, we go back to the reason of why does detention happen. And I liked what you said before about detention does not happen, and this is something we keep stating over and over again because people always ask us, why do you think they want to get rid of all the immigrants? Well, the reality of it is first world countries cannot get rid of all the immigrants, because what happens if you get rid of all the immigrants? You don't have people to do low-wage labor for you. Your economies fall apart. You need people. You need these immigrants to do this labor. You need immigrants to fill these positions. But you don't need them to organize. You don't need them to take back power. You don't need them to assert their own humanity. And so then we go into the reasons for detention being social control. And once again, this is where before we've traditionally drawn from the reasons prisons exist in the first world and to the reasons detention exists in the first world, and drawing the parallels between the war on drugs being something that put 2 million people of color in prison, took the right to vote away from millions of people, put whole communities in jail in situations where they were doing cheap labor and free labor in jails, and also to whole communities that were devastated, the whole communities that were initially organizing and mobilizing for their own liberation and then were then put in jail. And then we go into the situation with immigration and the historical roots of immigration. If you look at the roots as to why detention happens, right, and why detention has traditionally happened, you go back to not just the Patriot Act, not just the 1996 immigration laws, you go all the way back to the Alien and Sedition Acts and people that were traditionally detained. People that were traditionally detained, not only did they come from communities that they wanted to silence, they came from communities that they thought were potentially dangerous. They came from communities that were in the process of organizing. So if you look at the Black Liberation Movement, you look at what the Immigration and Naturalization Service's effect on the Black Liberation Movement was, people like Marcus Garvey were actively deported. If you look at the labor movement, people like Emma Goldman were deported. Half the labor movement in New York City's leadership that was often Eastern European immigrants was actively deported. You actively had voices of dissent that were removed from the country, voices of dissent that were completely disappeared from the country, right? And I'm sorry, my brain's a little scattered. So you have the use of detention, you have the use of prison, you have the use of institutions of apartheid to strike fear into communities, to change their day-to-day lives, to where it's legally okay to silence them. It's legally okay to treat them as effective non-human beings, right? And so then this becomes a question to everyone and a question to think about. And in terms of what we were talking about before, in terms of looking at the brothers and sisters that we work with in our communities, looking at the people that were disappeared, and another point that was brought up, people have talked about the Arabs, Muslims, and South Asians that were disappeared as objects. At the very least, when you look at publicly how they're talked about in the media, you have this whole group of people that talks about them as suspected terrorists and as criminals and as people that are illegal that shouldn't be here. But at the very best, you start the media and the public talk about them as objects, as victims, as poor immigrants that were working so hard here, right? And that's like the very best image that you get, you know, from the media, right? To me, this asks a question. Things like the Patriot Act, things like the 1996 immigration laws, were they preemptive and were they there to kill a movement? I think I know the answer to that question. And the reason I ask that question is everything that's lined out in terms of the Patriot Act, everything that's spelled out in terms of the 1996 immigration laws, even existed before the 1996 immigration laws. In 1987, you have a document put out by the Justice Department called an anti-terrorism contingency plan. Now, this document's really important because this document's actually been used in courts of law to argue that what happened to brothers and sisters in the Arab South Asian Muslim community amounted to racial profiling. You have a document put out by the Justice Department talking about a contingency plan in the event of a terrorist attack. And the contingency plan in the event of a terrorist attack looks remarkably similar to what we've seen go on. They're breaking down on people's doors at 6 o'clock in the morning, handcuffing them in front of their kids, putting them in jail, you know, forcing the act of deportation of people from very specific communities. Even gets into numbers. So was this preemptive? And when I ask questions like, was the Patriot Act preemptive? Let's look up at the group of folks that was detained by the INS after September 11th and who they are, who they were, who they could be, and the categories that they occupied in terms of who they were and where they came from in American society. Low income and working class, low income working class and Muslim, low income working class Muslim, people of color, people from third world communities, low income working class Muslim, people of color, third world immigrants. Let's look at different issues. Let's look at poverty. Let's look at the war that was going on, the war against terrorism, both abroad and at home. Let's look at racism. Let's look at globalization. And let's look at the repression of immigrants. And let's look at how important these groups, this group of people that have disappeared are and who they are and who they could be. And one of the things I think is what we're dealing with is that in this point in time, in this period in time, we're dealing with what is and could become the most potentially radical voices. We're dealing with families whose backs were against the wall, who are actively speaking out against the INS, and at the same time were actively speaking out against the war and could actively be speaking out against immigration policy. And so these aren't objects, and these aren't victims, and these aren't people to pity, and these aren't characters to write stories about. These are groups of people from our communities that were finding every way, shape, and form that they could to speak out, and looking for ways to express their voices whenever possible, whether it was through the use of hunger strikes, whether it was through the use of rallies, or whether it was just the ability to walk down the street to the masjid. In some days was a radical act and was a revolutionary act after September 11th in New York City. We saw communities that were there trying to find outlets and trying to find openings to express their rage at what was going on. And this is where it becomes important. This is where the disappeared become important. And this is where we have to stop looking at them as objects and as victims and start looking at our brothers and sisters that were detained by the INS and they're actively deported and their families as the, in this day and time, groups of people that in many ways were intuitively anti-war, intuitively against the immigration policies, intuitively against detention because their family members and loved ones were there, and intuitively had the desire to work against this. There's cases like, you know, the detention of our brother Farouk Abdul Muti that were really exemplary of this. Our brother who's a Palestinian activist who also had immigration issues that was detained by the INS 2 weeks ago and is still in detention, who has a son that, you know, we've been working with in a campaign to free him. But also looking at it in terms of the day-to-day lives of people in the community, people like Usman Ahid, whose husband and brother were both detained, who shortly after the detention would go everywhere speaking out against detention and speaking out against the injustice being perpetrated on her and her family by the Justice Department. You know, everyday voices of people in our community. You know, and the rallies that were being organized were more and more being occupied. The people that were participating in these rallies were more and more people from communities, from directly affected communities. I wanted to stop there and just leave that thought with people about why the work that's going on now, why grassroots work that's going on now in directly affected communities is so important, and why that work needs to be facilitated and supported in every way, shape, or form possible. Because it's not because we're helping so many people, or it's not because we're doing this, it's not because we're fixing objects. It's because the brothers and sisters in our community that are directly affected now are some of the most potentially radical voices. So I just wanted to leave it.
stuck with the workshops and leave time for a break before caucuses begin. Although I would leave it open for those that would like to do a few questions, I think it's important because maybe those people won't be able to participate in the caucus, although the caucus is a space for discussion.